John Perry, great to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on to talk Leafs all the way from your new home in Canada. So how's it been going since we last spoke? You've been to Ecuador doing some old David Attenborough things, haven't you?
Yeah. I went to Ecuador. We're putting together a tour that's going to be that's January 9th through the 11th, which, by the way, anyone in your audience is welcome to join too. I'm working with Nancy Miarelli. She's an entomologist down there. And she usually helps researchers, you know, go on tours and find the insects that they're interested in studying. But we're putting together a little evolution tour for the public. So, it's going to be 11 days technically, going around and exploring the jungles and the coastline of Ecuador. And yeah, it's going to be really cool.
You're known for the very, very successful Stated Clearly YouTube channel, where you present your simple and easy to understand digital animations about science and evolution. You also run the Stated Casually channel, which you host and talk about science and answer viewers' questions. And you even use these presentations at schools and colleges, which is pretty cool. And I'm always eager to find out what's coming up next on those channels. So what are you working on at the moment? You've just released something new, haven't you?
Right. Yeah, I just released a video on metabolism. And what is metabolism?
Food, water, and oxygen are constantly consumed by your cells. Waste products like CO2 are constantly expelled when you breathe.
I'm working on a second video for that, which talks about the metabolism first hypothesis for the origin of life. But before that gets published, I'm going to be publishing a video, what is a molecule, for UC Irvine. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing a series on chemistry, and I'm starting to wrap that up. And then I'll be going full force on evolution stuff in the future. So,
well, our original Talk Beliefs interview dealt with the development of your Stated Clearly YouTube channel, but today we're going to address this contention often brought up by creationists and evolution skeptics in general, the notion that evolution isn't really science because it's, according to them, not observable, not repeatable, not testable, nor falsifiable. So we're just going to go through those one by one and see if those criticisms are true. But before we start, John, let's just be clear on what a scientific theory is.
It's an explanation that links together a bunch of observations. So, you know, if you have, so germ theory, for example, people are getting sick. We used to think that it was bad smells that made people sick. And so people would, when diseases were breaking out, they would put a lot of perfume on and so on. And so that's actually called the entasma theory of disease, where bad smells cause disease. And that theory was put together with a bunch of observations. You know, you smell this bad stuff and then you end up getting sick. And that actually was, those are legitimate observations, right? And so people came to this conclusion that the bad smells caused the disease. And they were sort of right, because one of the things that's in something that smells bad is bacteria, right? You're actually smelling bacteria and rotten, you know, disease-causing agents sometimes when you smell bad smells. But they didn't understand, they didn't have all of the data there. And so as we started to understand that microorganisms are a thing, we started realizing that it's these germs that are causing disease, and a bad smell is just one cue that there are germs around. So the theory was replaced. We now have germ theory that's replaced entasma theory. And this is a pretty good model for how science works. So we take the observations that we have available to us. We tried to put them together in some sort of a coherent picture, an explanation. And then we use that explanation to hopefully go and find more data. If we don't have an overall picture of how something works that we can think about and kind of bounce our ideas off of, our exploration in science is there's no direction, right? So a theory really gives scientists a way to direct their experiments and so on. And a lot of times you'll hear people talk about falsifiability. like a good scientific theory should be falsifiable. And this comes from Karl Popper, who was really concerned with, you know, theories that were coming up in psychology that were basically just statements of belief. People would say, you know, Freud was coming out with a lot of things saying, there's these a lot of things are caused by penis envy and so on. And, he would just kind of make things up and propose these as if they were scientific theories. And Popper realized that, well, there's no way to falsify these statements that he's making. Therefore, they're not really scientific theories. There's something else. He's just, he called it pseudoscience. And so for a long time, there's this huge emphasis on, if you have a scientific theory, it needs to be falsifiable. So it means that there needs to be something you could do to prove your theory wrong. And from that kind of philosophical basis in science, people set out to try and disprove their own theories, disprove the different ideas that they were investigating. And that's still a pretty big part of science. But large theories, once a theory really becomes big, the theory of evolution is, germ theory is really big, the theory of evolution is really big. What I mean by big is they encompass tons of data sets. It becomes harder and harder to just actually falsify a theory the bigger it gets, because there's so much data and there's so much supporting that theory that when a theory gets to a certain size, it's really not falsifiable anymore. It has to be replaced. So, we saw germ theory replace its, you know, earlier theories about what causes disease. And the reason for that is that there's the scientific community will get momentum with an idea. And if you just say, oh, well, that idea is false, that leaves kind of this thought vacuum that you really need to fill it with something else instead of just saying, oh, that's false. When the theory gets really big, it needs to, if you want to change a theory, you need to replace it with something better. And something better would explain the facts, all the facts that we currently have, plus start leading people to new facts. And the theory of evolution did that. When Darwin published his theory of evolution by natural selection, it replaced the current ideas about why there's a diversity of life on Earth. And it accounted for all of the facts that we already had, and it started leading us to just thousands and thousands of new facts. It helped guide our research into all the discoveries that we've been making now in genetics and all sorts of things in medicine and biology and so on. So it was a very revolutionary theory. It really changed how we do biological research.
Let's start with these skeptic claims. The first one is a biggie, that evolution is not observable. This is what creationists point to the most as a big fly in the ointment, the notion that since you can't actually see evolution happening, that is, species changing over millions of years, that it's only speculation, or as they like to call it, a fairy tale for grown-ups. So let's get this one out of the way first. Is evolution observable?
Evolution really talks about two main things. There's two big parts to it. First of all, it's the idea that all life on Earth is related. And so that's a historical claim, right? And then you have the idea that evolution happens through natural processes. And there's observations that demonstrate both of those things. I think a lot of what creationists are upset about is these historical claims that life is all related. Those things can be observed by looking at the fossil record. I mean, fossils are real observable things. You can go and dig them up and you can look at them and you can show them to someone else and they're going to see the same thing that you're seeing. And the more carefully you study these fossils, you can start to discover clues about, the best ways to interpret the fossil record.
Yeah, it's like forensics, isn't it? I mean, right. It's like when a murder happens, you've got all these clues, you've got a body, you don't see the murder happening.
Right.
So similar to that.
When Darwin first proposed this idea, and actually if you read The Origin of Species, he says, I don't know how far back my theory works. You know, maybe there's 1,000 original species that were first created. Darwin, kind of depending on the version of his book that you're looking at, he gives more credence to creationism or less, because creationism was the main idea in his time. There was it's not the same as young earth creationism is today, but there was a just kind of an assumption that the biblical God created everything, because all of the biologists at the time that were in Darwin's circles, they were all Christians. Science wasn't really an international endeavor at that time. It was, but the scientists from different cultures weren't communicating with each other. So you could have things like religious ideas that would be seeping into science and nobody would even notice. It's so much, it's the water that everyone was swimming in that they wouldn't even notice. But Darwin had this, you know, he said, I don't know how far back you can take this, but species split from each other and the diversity of life that we see today, you know, there are common ancestors and there's this evolutionary process. And he made predictions that, you know, we should see when we go back in the fossil record, we should see forms that are very distinct today. As you follow them back in the fossil record, they should become less distinct and they should actually, there should be a common ancestor between them. And just 2 years after he published his book, Archaeopteryx was discovered.
That's right.
And that was absolutely huge. I mean, this is a very obvious observation confirming the predictions that Darwin had made. Now, of course, this is a prediction of an animal that existed in the past. And sometimes creationists that don't want to understand this, that are working hard not to understand this, will try and say things like, oh, well, that's not a prediction because it's something that existed in the past. The predictions are for the future. But it was a discovery that happened in the future, right? I mean, Darwin made his theory, and then in the future, 2 years in the future, we discovered this fossil. That was a huge confirmation. And it was a really big deal because Archaeopteryx shows a very clear intermediate between reptile-like ancestors mm-hmm. and modern birds. And it was just spectacular. You got this animal with claws and teeth and a big, long reptilian tail, and it's got feathers. It was absolutely stunning. And it was really just serendipity that discovery was made so quickly after Darwin published his theory, and that it was made by people that hated Darwin. So Richard Owens, he was the guy who described Archaeopteryx, and he was an anti-evolutionist. He was very much against the theory of evolution, but he had this fossil and he has had integrity to describe it accurately. And it was then on display in the Natural History Museum. So it was just, everyone could see what it was. So it's a very interesting time in the history of science. And that was just the first of many, many discoveries that just confirmed Darwin's ideas.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
And that fossil is actually not too far away from me in the Natural History Museum in London. Yeah. I think it is that first. I know there's about 12 specimens, aren't there? But that was that one that you were talking about. So yeah, I've got to see that up close, which is quite exciting.
Right. So we can observe evolution happening when we look in the fossil record. We can actually just observe it. We can observe the the histories of these different organisms throughout the history of the fossil record. So that's if you want to observe the idea that we all share a common ancestor, you look at the fossils. That's where you can actually see that. The other way that we can observe evolution is we can observe evolution happening today, of course, and we observe that with experiments in the lab. But we also observe that with like the production of domesticated crops and domesticated animals. I've got behind me, I've got some dog skulls here. Cool. So this here, I'm not sure how well this is going to show up. This is a wolf skull. And here, which is significantly larger, that wolf, by the way, it's a Mexican gray wolf, which is one of the smaller gray wolves. But when we look at the fossil record of dogs, it seems that they came from a mid-sized species, subpopulation of gray wolves. This here is a Great Dane, and it's significantly larger. But it looks very similar. I mean, the snout is shorter, but compared to the wolf's snout, mm-hmm. I mean, overall it's larger, but the snout's a little bit shorter. Other than that, it looks a lot like a wolf skull. Then you've got this. This is a white terrier, which looks extremely different from a wolf. And actually, if we would have found this in the fossil record, we would have thought that it was a different species. It's significantly different. And then you've got a French bulldog right here.
Wow. Oh, yeah. You could probably guess that.
Right. And these extreme variations, if you just look back at historical records, you can see pictures of these different dog breeds. And they're not nearly as extreme as they are today. And we've been able to selectively breed dogs to get all these weird forms. Really, in a matter of the past few hundred years, a lot is when most of these changes have happened since kennel clubs started. You know, and actually,
just artificial selection, not natural. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah. I kind of think of those things as the same. You've got an organism that's evolving to fit the resources that are available in its niche environment. And what niche environment are dogs evolving in? They're evolving in our living rooms. So actually, you have the flat-faced dogs are super popular, especially among like people who don't have children, which is pretty interesting because these things trigger a babying, a parenting response in us. There's a mutation that causes the short snout. It stunts the growth on the top of the nose compared to the rest of the skull. And actually it stunts the length of the skull's growth. There's a lot of really interesting changes that happen in this. It's one mutation that we found. It's in a gene called RUNX2. And basically it makes the gene, it makes this protein less sticky. And for some reason, we don't know why, but for some reason, when this protein is less sticky to its target, it's actually a signaling molecule, signaling protein. When it's less sticky, it stunts the length of the skull's growth. And actually the bull terrier has a mutation in the exact same gene that makes it more sticky, and it causes the top of the nose to grow way faster, and it curves down. So actually, if I were to hold this, if I hold the brain case parallel to the ground, its face curves down like that. It's like its face is melted almost. If I do the same with a wolf, it sticks almost straight out.
Straight out.
And what's happened is you've just had rapid growth on the top of the nose because of this one mutation. And it's really interesting. So the bull terrier and the French bulldog have the opposite mutations essentially, but on the same gene. And this is all stuff that has happened. I mean, we're able to do this over the course of 100 years of selective breeding, selecting for these mutations. And these dogs have been able to serve different, these different dog groups are serving different needs for us humans. You know, you got the French bulldog that makes us feel like parents and makes us feel good when we're lonely. And you've got, yeah, just all the different types of traits and niches that these dogs have evolved to fit. It's really interesting to think about this as they're evolving.
Evolved to fit the human ego, basically.
Yeah. So this is an example of directly observed evolution. I mean, our species has been documenting the changes in morphology of these dogs over time. And now we have the ability to actually look at their genetics and see what the heck these breeders were actually doing when they were selecting for these traits, what types of mutations were happening, what types were being selected for. And it's a really fascinating direct observation of evolution.
We'll go on to the next one. Is evolution repeatable? I guess the skeptics are saying that if it takes millions of years for a reptile to evolve into a mammal, then you can't repeat that. So it's a bit like is it observable thing, I suppose. Is that right?
To really understand something in science, we want to be able to watch it happen multiple times, right? There's an aspect to evolution that is very much based on chance. Like to get the mutation that you need to shorten the face of a dog, for example, that's a chance occurrence. And then someone selected for it by, you know, letting that dog reproduce a whole bunch. And then you have basically dog breeders are then waiting for another mutation to make the face even shorter. And then they'll select for that. So there's this aspect of evolution that really is chance, and it's not necessarily repeatable. But what we do in the lab, when we're studying evolution, so there's the Linsky experiment, the long-term evolutionary experiment on bacteria. And what he did is he took a clone, he made a clone of a bunch of bacteria, so they're all identical. He split them up into 12 groups, and then he let those 12 groups evolve in a solution that he prepared. And so he took them, he put them in a slightly new environment, something that they were not super well adapted to, different food sources than what they were used to, some food sources that they were used to already. And he let them just breed, and every day he would switch them into a new solution so they could breed again. And he would just he did that for 25 years, these 12 different groups. And you can see that each group evolves slightly different traits because there's different mutations that are happening by chance in these different populations. But you get a lot of convergence on some of the same even though the genetics might be slightly different, the phenotype, like the actual, the look of these different microbes and the different, he's talked about, oh, I got 12 of them, so 12 tribes. These 12 tribes of bacteria, they would evolve the same phenotypes oftentimes.
So it's observable and repeatable, but I can hear the skeptics now saying they're still bacteria. Nothing's changed. Of course, they think evolution is, you know, salamander into a giraffe. It has to be this extreme observable change.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A Little Bit de Todo is a podcast about a little bit of everything for curious minds of all ages. I'm Christina, and you can tune in every weekday to learn about things like Cinco de Mayo, Chihuahuas, and volcanoes in Latin America. Episodes are bite-sized, 10 minutes long or less, and always Latin American related. Subscribe and follow A Little Bit de Todo podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's observing bacteria evolve in a very limited condition. We do have other experiments that are designed to get more complexity to evolve. So his experiment wouldn't really promote complexity, because what he's doing is actually simplifying their environment. He's taking out, there's no predators, it's just the same thing they're exposed to every day. So what you get in that case is you get refining evolution. The very first thing that happens in his experiments is the bacteria will start to lose all the traits that are not usable in that environment. mutations that knock out a gene that they no longer even need, those will actually be a selective advantage, because now that bacteria, the individual that lost that gene is no longer carrying this baggage that it doesn't need. You can kind of think of it as a soldier from Vietnam coming home. He had the gun, he had the helmet, he had, you know, whatever kind of body armor on. Well, if he's walking around downtown New York with his helmet and his gun, trying to get a job, you know, trying to make a living in his new environment.
Bit superfluous, to say, yeah.
Those tools are going to be a disadvantage to him. So when you simplify an environment the way that they did in the Linsky experiment, you actually get a simplification of the organisms, and then they'll start to develop new traits that are genuinely new that help them exploit all the little niches in that new environment. So you get, at first in his experiments, what you mostly see is a simplification of the genome of these bacteria, and then you start to see the building up, which is a much slower process, of new traits in there. And in some cases, you know, you have gene duplications, and then you have mutations that give new abilities to these different microbes. So we are seeing genuine, novel genetic information evolving in these cases. But to really get phenotypic complexity, you need a complex environment with lots of challenges in it. And so there's been a lot of experiments where you take, like, I have a video that shows this. My video, What Caused Life's Major Evolutionary Transitions, is it shows an experiment where they took these microbes. I believe they were eukaryotes. They were they're single-celled organisms, but they're fairly complex. They're the types that have a nucleus, and they're related to us. Actually, they're eukaryotes like we are, but they're single-celled. And they put in a predator that could eat them, and it could swallow individuals, but it had trouble eating groups of these single-celled organisms. So if they were stuck to each other, it couldn't swallow them. And you saw the rapid evolution of, at first they would just stick to each other like crazy. But when they were stuck in huge clumps, the predator couldn't eat them, but they also couldn't use resources in their environment very well. So you'd have a lot of die-offs. And over the course of a few weeks, it might have been a few months, they actually evolved the number seven. Seven cells would stick together, and then they would stop letting cells. The cells would divide and stick to each other up to seven, and then they would slough off. And so you had this evolution of the perfect body size to avoid getting eaten by the predator, but also be able to get all the nutrients and stuff they needed from their environment. So this is really cool. Evolution of new phenotypic complexity. I mean, you went from a single-celled organism to a really simple multi-celled organism. But we just witnessed that in the lab, happening in the laboratory. So,
okay, John, the next one is testable. The idea that you can't test the evolutionary process, but tests are done all the time, isn't that right? Examining, for instance, what's found in strata and predicting where fossils will be found, for instance, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've kind of already gone over the actual experiments where you can literally watch evolution happening. And, you know, breeding dogs is one way to watch change occur, these bacterial experiments and so on. And then, of course, yeah, making predictions about the fossil record and then going and finding those in the actual fossil record. Evolution has been well studied. It was really accepted by the scientific community, the idea that we all share a common ancestor and that we evolved through natural processes. Those two ideas were really pretty much accepted by the scientific community sort of during Darwin's lifetime, but shortly following his death. It was very quickly adopted as far as a, you know, groundbreaking theory. You know, obviously it's going to take time for something to get adopted, but it was adopted very quickly and accepted very quickly. And since then, we've really just been using it. We've been using that theory to find new information. It's not, scientists don't spend a lot of time trying to prove or disprove the theory of evolution anymore, because that's really old news, you know. But Yeah, we do experiments to try and tease out more and more the details about how variation arises within populations. Mm. So Darwin showed us that through the process of descent with modification, so when parents have offspring, those offspring are often slightly different than their parents. That's descent with modification. So with descent with modification plus selection, you get adaptive evolution. And so scientists have been studying how does modification arise? How does descent with modification occur? And there's all sorts of mutations that cause this. There's crossover events that happen when animals that can reproduce sexually are doing that. There's that can actually produce novelty when you reshuffle the traits of the mother and the father. You can get novelty that way. I wouldn't really call that a mutation. It's the reshuffling of traits, of genes. You've got horizontal gene transfer. You've got a bunch of different mechanisms that have been discovered over the years. And then scientists are trying to figure out how it is that selection works. So under different special circumstances, how does selection work when you have two organisms come together that could benefit by helping each other out? Under what conditions will evolution allow them to discover that they can do better cooperating versus competing with each other? So there's a lot of math and theory involved in how selection works, and under what conditions, what sorts of outcomes are we likely to see? So we've basically just been filling in the details. Darwin figured this out. He was wrong about some things. He was right about the foundational aspects of this, and we've just been flushing things out since then.
Okay, John, the last one on our list is falsifiable, which, of course, you've already defined for us. So what would falsify evolution?
Well, I guess we could just recap real quickly. When you have a theory, for example, that disease is caused by germs, you can falsify that by finding a disease that's not caused by germs. And we actually do have cases of that. There are some diseases that are caused by genetic mutations. There are some diseases that are caused by prions, some diseases caused by toxins that are. So aspects of this idea that germs cause all diseases, that actually has been falsified by the discovery of these other things that can cause diseases. But it didn't falsify germ theory in general, because we still have a bunch of diseases that are caused by germs. But it you can falsify individual statements. So is the flu caused by a germ? In that case, it's caused by a virus. And you can falsify that by discovering, if you were to discover that, no, the flu is actually caused by too much lead in your environment or something. That's not the case, but that would be a way to falsify that. And so the theory of evolution being a huge theory, just like germ theory being a huge theory, it's hard to falsify the entire thing, but you can definitely falsify parts of it. And when you falsify parts of it, that causes a reworking of that part of that theory. And people have tried to think about ways, like how would you falsify the entire theory of evolution? And probably the most famous example of something that would work to falsify the idea that we all share a common ancestor would be to find a rabbit in the Cambrian.
Yeah.
That's been touted a lot. So, and the reason that would falsify things is that we find that, before the Cambrian is a time period, a very early time period in the evolution of animals. Before the Cambrian,
about 500 million years ago, isn't it? So there's obviously no rabbits at that point.
Right. Well, yeah. Before the Cambrian, you have worm-like creatures and a bunch of weird things that we don't really know where they fit in the phylogeny of animals today. And then we believe that from those worms, there was a diversification that happened. And in the Cambrian rocks, we can start to see these differentiated animals. We see the earliest vertebrates. They're these really primitive chordates that look superficially kind of like fish. And they eventually gave rise to fish. You have arthropods, so things that would eventually give rise to insects and so on. But you don't have anything living on land. You have plants living on land. You don't have animals living on land. You don't have vertebrates. You don't even have things with actual backbones. you've just got really simple chordates. And eventually we see a group, we see these chordates evolve into fish, and these fish evolve into these amphibian-like creatures. These amphibian-like creatures give rise to these reptile-like creatures. A group of them ends up giving rise to mammals, and then a group of those mammals gives rise to rabbits. And so it's been said that if you find a rabbit in the Cambrian, that screws up our entire picture of the evolutionary history of life. Now, if it were to happen, if we were to find a rabbit skeleton in Cambrian rock, probably the first thing that would happen is we'd be like, are we sure that that wasn't a rabbit that dug a hole into the Cambrian rock and died in there? And there's ways to tell that, by the way. It's not hard to figure that out. So that would be the first thing. It's like, this is an extraordinary claim. It goes against a whole mountain of evidence that we've already found. So people will be very skeptical of it at first. But once it was undeniable that this rabbit actually died in the Cambrian, that would dramatically screw up our confidence in our history of life on Earth. So that would falsify the history of life that we have put together. So that is a way that the theory of evolution could be falsified. But of course, that would not falsify the fact that evolution can be observed today, and we can see it in the lab. Seeing how the scientific community would deal with this would be super interesting, because I actually don't know exactly how things would change, but things would definitely change. So,
okay. Seems that evolution does meet its burden of proof, but now I guess it's up to the skeptics to decide whether or not to accept it. So what would you say to anybody who has been watching this and are still not convinced? Where could they go from here to find answers?
Are you asking like online, what types of materials should they look at?
Videos, I think, to start with.
Oh yeah. Yes. Watch my videos. the evidence for evolution videos has been pretty helpful for a lot of people. But also the, what caused life's major evolutionary transitions is really good, because it shows one way in which quite dramatic complexity emerges through the process of evolution, mainly through a type of symbiosis. And so you can go and watch that and see how a lot of these big transitions happen. How did you go from single cell to multi-cell? How did you go from multi-cell to something like bees, where there's this intense cooperation in the beehive, the whole hive acts as a single organism? How do these transitions happen? So that video is going to be really helpful. I've also got some on how does new genetic information evolve, and so on. There's also a series of talks that I found super helpful by Richard Dawkins. It's like Waking Up in the Universe. It's a series that Richard Dawkins did at the Royal Institution. He did the Christmas lectures there, and it's extremely well done. Dawkins now is known for being kind of this sour old atheist that is just fed up with creationists. At the time, he was younger and less bitter. And I think even creationists will find his talks back then a lot more, a lot friendlier. Though I think he does take a couple jabs throughout the talks. And so, I don't know, some people might find it a little bit jarring to watch, but I really like it. He explains how a lot of these really complex structures emerge in biology. And that was actually the thing that got me really excited about teaching evolution, is watching that series of videos. So I would recommend that.
There are people like, I know I've watched lectures, which you can find online by Donald Prothero, Jerry Coyne. Very interesting. And they make it palatable. They make it easily digestible.
Yeah. As far as books go, there's one of my favorite books is called Evolution in Minutes. And it's just it's a book that's got a bunch of, like, they're like one page articles on different topics in evolution. Hmm. And if you use that plus the internet, you know, you get introduced to the topic in that little book, and then you go online and read a whole bunch more about it. Or if you use that plus a textbook, it's a really good way to to learn things from the start. Because a lot of times I think if you just read a textbook, huge chunks of what you're reading is going to be stuff you've already heard before. Same with any book that you read. That's why I like this little book so much, because you can skip through the stuff you already understand, find out what you haven't heard of, and just dig in. You know, I think for someone who was raised with a creationist worldview, evolution is a very extraordinary claim for you if you happen to be in that camp. Mm. And so it's going to require extraordinary evidence, right, to convince you that this is something worth paying attention to. And but I think if you're just patient and maintain interest, if this is something interesting to you, you start reading, eventually it's going to start making sense. That was my history. I was, you know, I had a type of Mormon creationism in my head when I first started this. I was raised Mormon, as some of your viewers may know. And it took a while.
We did a whole show on that, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. It took a while for me to break through some of the, you know, to change my thinking a little bit. I guess another really good resource that I should point out is biologos.org, because biologos.org is an evangelical group. They're evangelical Christians that are basically saying it's okay to understand evolution and study evolution. And so their website, they have a bunch of articles that address all of these things from a Christian perspective. And that, I think, is really helpful, because, you know, I am now, depending on how you define atheist, I'm an atheist. I think that's your case as well. Richard Dawkins as well. And I think it's helpful to see what people in your own tribe are saying about this sort of thing. And what I like about BioLogos is that they are evangelical Christians, but they don't compromise the science. They teach the science just as it is. I don't know a whole lot about their theology, but it doesn't seem like they're letting the science muddy their theology either. They're kind
of, is this then what you would call theistic evolution? The idea that, yeah, there's a God that kicked everything off, and then it seems that things evolved. I don't know where Adam and Eve fit into all that, but
yeah,
perhaps, well, that's the way to look at it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important that they promote a little bit is that you don't have to know the answers in order to start studying something. Like, it's okay for there to be these conflicting ideas, even in your own brain. It's okay to have this cognitive dissonance to idea. In science, we have to do this all the time. You hear of a new theory or a new way of looking at some data, and you have the already established theory or the already established way of looking at this data, and you need to take a break from that briefly to investigate this new idea to see if there's any merit to it. And that type of exercise is really important. We have to constantly be able to step away from our current worldview. I'm not saying you have to throw it away. Step aside from it and investigate something from a new perspective. That's a very important skill to have in life in general, you know? And so that's if you're a Christian and you're coming at this and evolution might be offensive, it seems to be at odds with your religious beliefs, it's okay to just let that be the case, but study it anyways. And when you're studying it, just sincerely follow the data where you think it leads. And I'm quite convinced that if you can successfully do that, you'll come to the same conclusion I did, but not necessarily about atheism, but you'll come to the same conclusion that there's something very special about Darwin's discovery of evolution. He really was onto something, and this is an important thing for us to understand.
Okay, John, thanks so much for coming back onto the show. I'm always excited to talk to you about your work. I will leave links to your YouTube channels, Stated Clearly and Stated Casually, in the description below. Plus, of course, cool, all your social media links. And all that's left to say is thanks once again for helping all of us to stay curious.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It was fun.